Hello and welcome to Wax Lyrical, the advertising and marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark Renikus.
Hi, I'm Paul Jacobs.
And in this episode, we're talking about humour in advertising. Today, our guest is Graham Daldry, creative director, strategist and writer, and for the past 21 years, the driving force behind the famous Should Have Gone to Specsavers advertising campaign. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome, Graham. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. Very kind of you to ask me. I'm deeply flattered by that. Thank you.
Now, from my point of view, the Specsavers campaign is famous for two things. One, for being very funny. Some might say the most consistently funny advertising campaign of all time. But also, I think it's because all the work is created in-house at Specsavers. Take me on that journey that took you from traditional ad agency to in-house creative.
To be honest with you, it was actually my kids, because I was working in London, commuting from here, I wasn't seeing them, and I was looking. So I decided to see if I could find a different sort of job, and that's really what led me to work for Specsavers, because I went to the headhunter with that brief. And she came up with a few things that would probably have been far worse. But this one seemed really interesting. And I think what was interesting about it was that Specsavers seemed such an interesting brand to work with, you know. Nobody'd really used humour effectively for optics before, and I love using humour. And that might seem a bit of a strange place to start, you know, can I use humour in this job? But actually, it's always been quite important to me. So, and that was the challenge, really. It was, you know, how can we get some life and likability into a brand like Specsavers, which had always been populist and very approachable and, you know, accessible from a kind of commercial point of view. In fact, you know, its commercial position was always to make glasses affordable and affordable for everyone. And they entered the market on that basis. But they'd never really taken that through into their advertising. So it just seemed such an interesting proposition.
Great to hear it's a family-led decision as well. Often people say it's kind of, I wanted to explore myself or a different way of doing things, which of course you have over the time you've been there. But yeah. Refreshing to hear kind of an honest family decision that kind of inspired you to start looking elsewhere.
Well, all your humour and words come from kids, really, don't they, in my view? You know, and it's like, you know, they're so fresh and everything they say is amazing. And it's just like the more you can be around them if you get the chance, you know, it's just such a great thing to... So it's, I know this sounds weird, but, you know, in terms of, you know, writing and being a writer, you have to kind of absorb what kids say. Somebody said that creativity was thinking like children. I can't remember who that was actually, but it's a very good, very good quote.
I guess you've asked the question kind of why did you move it in-house? And it's beautifully simple, but should we, let's start and kind of talk about, as we dive more into creativity, some of your favourite ads, Graham. So outside of work you've done at Specsavers, could you choose one that would be your favourite advert?
Well, yeah. So I've been wrestling with this because it's such a hard question. And actually it's really interesting how few ads, even as someone that works in the industry and watches ads constantly, that you remember off the top of your head, you know, it's really kind of... Very, I think you see so much stuff these days that very little recent stuff sticks.
It's a question you feel like you should have an easy answer for, but it is not an easy answer.
It is, yeah. And, you know, I mean, I do have a favorite ad of all time, which I'm not sure I should reveal right now, but I think that, you know, you go back to the ads that you remember when, you know, you were a kid and when you were growing up, and also when you were sort of first thinking of working in advertising. So, probably first up, you know, which this is an ad that probably influenced me when I was feeling my way as a copywriter into sort of doing some decent work as opposed to just sort of trotting out, you know, ads for regional agencies, was the Tango Man, which kind of changed the way I think creatives thought about advertising, or it did certainly outside the small circle of creatives that came up with it. And it was a very influential ad for creatives, I think. It was a bit of a game changer. Yeah. It definitely engendered a whole generation of absolutely dreadful advertising, but it also did, it also changed the way that you thought about what was possible. It changed the way clients thought about what was possible, and it changed the sort of definition of humor in advertising. And it did that thing where, you know, I think humor has become increasingly difficult to use over the years because, as you know, all good jokes require, you know, a fall guy or a fall person rather. And I think, you know, the trying to find jokes that are very funny, but also actually tellable as a, you know, as on behalf of a brand and also obviously that are capable of getting past the advertising authorities is a tricky one. And it trod that line very well, pushed the boundary a bit, took the sort of, you know, the whole thing about who would be the butt of the joke into a different area. And by defining something completely different as the butt of a joke. And you know, I think it did something very, very interesting. And of course the other thing about it was it was infinitely repeatable, which obviously got Tango into a bit of trouble. But it was one of those things that, you know, that was reenacted everywhere.
Hello, Tony. I think we might use a video replay here.
Super, Ralph. Let's do that.
Oh, yes, we could be in for a quintessential Tango Chase sensation here. Why, yes, Tony, let's look again.
Yes, Ralph. The big orange fella ran in from the left, and he gives him a good old slapping.
It just illustrates the bite and buzz... Oh, a real oranges in Tango.
Yes, Ralph, super taste sensation, smashing drink, lovely.
You know when you've been tangoed.
Do you remember the agency that made it?
It was Trevor Robinson, OBE, of Howell Henry, who I have met, and he is a fascinating, funny, and absolutely lovely top bloke as well. And he and I got into a very deep conversation about music when he lived in Clapham, because I told him I lived in Clapham. He said, oh, I was brought up on a council estate in Clapham. Anyway, it went on and on. But of course, Howell Henry was a bit of an iconoclastic agency in itself, but it was an ad made in an agency. And I want to talk about ads that aren't made in agencies. So what's the big difference? What's the big difference when it's in-house versus making an ad in an agency?
Well, the obvious difference is that as a creative, you're much closer to the client. You know, I mean, I always thought of the marketing guys and the people that I work for as the client, because it's a kind of a good discipline to kind of keep that sort of, I think that sort of slightly adversarial relationship works. It allows you to be a bit irresponsible. And it allows you to compete with agencies who are obviously you have to be better than agencies if you work in-house. So I always think of it like that. But I think, you know, being able to, if you don't like something, being able to walk into the marketing director's office and find out why it's happened is just such an advantage as a creative, because you get the business story. You don't get, you know, some bullshit that someone's made up, or not that anybody ever does that, of course, but... you don't get, you know, or someone trying to cover their ass, or, you know, or just, you know, make things sound better than they are. You just get the story. And if you've got the story, you can go away and work on it, can't you? You know, you can go away and think, right, okay, well, those are the goalposts. So let's see what we can do with that. And it sometimes it does have it has a massive advantage, obviously, because you just have that relationship with the client. And if you have a good client, it means you do amazing work, I think. And I honestly think that it allows you to do better work than the agency relationship, where you have layers of people probably at both ends. Unless, you know, and I know some agency relationships are very close, and I think some agency creatives do get close to the client, but it just gives you, you know, you're part of it. You're in there. You're basically in the same building. And if you walk into the marketing director's office, they're not going to turn around and, you know, and ask you what you're doing there. They're actually mostly open to having a conversation. So it's that's the big advantage. the disadvantage is that you have less support when you when things are going wonky, or you know, when things are, you know, if you've got good people around you in an agency, you know, I did miss that a bit from time to time. But of course, you can always bring people in. You know, you can always ask people to come and help, which we always did. So I think it's got a lot to recommend it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I would position Specsavers in the nicest possible way as kind of the exception, not the rule, in terms of good work coming out of in-house. And that's something that our industry carries, and it's important to kind of to challenge that somewhat. I guess outside of the, as you mentioned, people around you, are there any other distinctive differences in the process that you think would differ kind of in-house from an external agency?
I did somewhat. I got asked to speak at the Creative Producers Conference a couple of months ago, and slightly flippantly suggested actually that when you work in-house, the whole process works backwards. As a creative, you're there right at the beginning, so you hear the business problem. And of course, you know, when you hear the business problem, creatives always flip straight to the execution, don't they? They don't really sit there and go, well, what's the best strategy for this? And how do you kind of, you know, address this and that? And what's the research going to say? You come up with what you know is a great creative idea, and then you kind of work back from there, you know, and sell it back to the client. And that is kind of what we did. You know, should have came about quite early on in my time at Specsavers, but even so, we were writing the sort of sight test, the sight gags, before we came up with the line, because so we knew where we wanted to be, you know. And that's a good example of what I mean of, you know, by working backwards. We were kind of writing the ads, and then we kind of found the line. You know, I don't know if you saw the ad where the girl runs up to the wrong guy on the station and she kisses some horrible fat bloke instead of her very good boyfriend.
Hi. Sorry.
We wrote that ad probably 2 years before we came up with the should have line. And it was, you know, to be fair, you know, I mean, Specsavers were very open to using humour, but it wasn't an easy road. You know, it wasn't let's do humour, because they're an optician. And opticians are serious, you know, serious people with serious skills. So it was quite a, it wasn't an easy journey. To come back to your question, you as a creative, you sort of have that permission to look at what you think will work, or without all that clutter of, you know, kind of, yeah, but that's off brief and that's off strategy and this is, you know, that and the other. And, you know, and as the departments got bigger, you know, we started working with planners and, you know, all that. And things do get more complicated, you know, we had a very small team of people. And, you know, it was a very small group of people that were making the decisions way back when I first started. And, you know, it does that helps too.
I'd like to talk quite a lot more about humour in advertising, because as a planner, I am genuinely in awe of anybody who can make it work. So let's come back to that. But I think Paul and I would love to hear what your second favourite ad is, so we can reminisce a bit more. So what's favourite ad number two?
Right. Well, this is the ad that I remember noticing when I was actually a kid before I, you know, this is kind of the ad that planted the idea that advertising could be interesting in my head. And it was the Arkwright series of ads with John Smith's. And I remember them really well. And I remember them, I think, because they were a consistent story, you know, and I think that taught me probably very subconsciously that consistency is a huge thing in advertising, as is consistency that can be varied. And I think that, you know, that is something that I've always had as a gold standard for a campaign, is that you have an element of consistency, but you have also that, you know, kind of delightful variation that allows you to play within a framework that people will nevertheless instantly recognize. And I think that is the golden egg, you know, where if you get that. And I think that is what we created in the end with Should Have, is that kind of, you know, that framework within which you can play that gives you liberty to do all kinds of stuff. And I think that, you know, Arkwright, I don't know how long that lasted. It was a few years, I think. I don't know. It wasn't a massively long-lived campaign, but I do remember it really well. I remember the character very well.
Well, for our listeners, Graham, do us the kindness and describe kind of the ad that you remember, kind of as this is audio.
The most famous one was probably called Dog Tricks. And it featured Arkwright and his sidekick. I can't actually remember. They were both quite famous actors, and Arkwright was a dour elderly Yorkshireman with a flat cap who only really spoke when the subject was John Smith's bitter. And his dog was of the same mould. And he takes his dog to the pub, and you see it over the counter. You don't see the dog. You just see these two guys. And I think this pair of ears sticking up. And Arkwright says, "Oh, this is my dog." And the other guy says, "Oh, it doesn't do much, does he?" And then Arkwright looks at him and he stares ahead, and there's a kind of pregnant pause. And then he says, "Do you fancy a drop of bitter?
Fancy a drop of John Smith's?"
And the dog then performs all these magic, these tricks. And, you know, with what was probably quite a lot of advanced post-production at the time.
John Smith's bitter. A tough act to follow.
I don't know what they probably used a model or something, whatever, but the dog's pretty convincing. And I think, you know, actually thinking about it, probably that is why it stuck in your mind, because, you know, it was probably, you know, of its time, pretty advanced in terms of the way it used production tricks and, you know, kind of got the dog to do all these things. And of course, you know, it's an animal. So, you know, there's another lesson there, which is, you know, always try and get
always
an animal.
Always work with animals.
You know, I think if you watch the whole series, you know, they're amazingly well written. I think they were all written by John Webster. The writing is brilliant. The casting is absolutely awesome. And of course, in those days, you know, I think getting talent like that into ads was obviously much, much easier, to be honest with you. And and the level of craft is very, very high. You know, it was made by people that knew what they were doing when it came to communicating with people. And I think, you know, that shines through. Yeah, I highly recommend. There's a whole series of them, and I highly recommend watch, because they're really worth looking at.
I wonder if there's an entire YouTube channel dedicated to them, because you know you've got your own YouTube channel, which you didn't make, obviously. How does that make you feel?
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it?
There's an entire YouTube channel of Specsavers ads. There's loads and loads of compilations that your fans have made.
Yeah, and people make their own, you know, and sometimes you get some quite good ones.
What, people make parodies of your ads?
People make their own shitters.
Mm. Tell us about them. Go on, I don't think I've got that yet. This is obviously a meme I need to explore.
Yeah, I'm not sure they possibly get sort of cease and desist notices, I don't know, or removed. So there may not be that many around. But quite often, you know, they get posted on Facebook, and they're very much encouraged. I'm desperately trying to remember one now. They tend to be, you know, the sort of you've been framed moments, you know, those that sort of thing. I mean, you've been framed is basically should have gone Specsavers, isn't it, really? We've talked about sponsoring that program so many times. It's basically the should have show.
Great kind of segue for us to talk a bit more about should have. And you've already touched on, like, it's now part of the cultural language, isn't it? You know, people using it in their daily when they, as you said, a you've been framed a moment is quite a nice way of summing it up. That kind of should have gone to Specsavers is now that thing. And you created that. So I guess off the back of kind of talking about John Smith and the Arkwright family, kind of a real DNA of humour, which is clearly evident in should have. But wind us back a little bit and kind of tell us about kind of how that started. And you touched on it, kind of it existed before the line. So tell us about that journey.
Yeah. So the ads, you know, we'd written a couple of should have ads way before we actually came up with the line, The line actually, I did write the line, and it was in a piece of dialogue that we wrote. The line was, "Dad, you should have gone to Specsavers." And it you know, the small group of creatives that I was working with, we all kind of went, yeah, that's the line for the sight gags. You know, I think a couple of people in the marketing team got it straight away. Maybe a couple of didn't, but the upshot of it was that it was adopted as the end line. And we ran an ad with it. And I think within a week, we had people repeating it to each other. It worked straight away. People were using it as, you know, mate, you need glasses, you need a sight test straight away. And have never stopped, you know, and it's just been... It was actually quite extraordinary. You know, I'd had a couple of ads before where, you know, people would take a catchphrase and use it. But nothing anywhere approaching that. And it's sustained itself as much as being sustained by us.
Did you know what you stumbled onto at the time?
Oh, I think we all knew it was the right line. I mean, I think everybody knew it was the right line. I think it was one of those things that you look at and you go, yeah, that's it, you know. That doesn't happen too often.
No, obviously it's fascinating because it's rare, right? And I think kind of it, yeah. The beauty is its simplicity. But along the line, did you ever challenge yourself to try and do something different? Because arguably you've been very consistent and I assume the commercials back that up. But as a creative, did you ever challenge yourself and your team to think, why don't we try something different?
Marketing teams are there to make sure that you know you're doing the right thing, and you know we've constantly over the years been asked to look at alternatives, and of course, you know, and it's interesting to look at that because you know you want to make sure that you know there isn't anything better out there. So yeah, of course, you know, all the time, and but we always end up coming back to it because it was such a force. It was massively popular. You know, I think the one thing that probably everybody was terrified of, including me at the beginning, was that, you know, the stores, because Specsavers is a partnership. It's not a franchise, and the store owners have a stake in the business. And everybody was, you know, terrified that the actual opticians, who you know mostly own and run the stores, you know, would not like it or see it as flippant. But everybody loved it, and it was instantly a talking point. And you know, the feedback was always really positive. And, you know, whenever we stopped using it, you know, the feedback would always be, oh, you know, why have you stopped using that? Where's the next one? Where's the next one? You know, that's the question that we always got asked. Where's the next one? What's the next one? So, yeah, and you know you're onto a winner when you're in that situation, aren't you? And it's gone, you know, and it's lasted now, you know, it's 18 years down the road now. It's a long-running thing. And I think, you know, it's probably, you know, in some ways, a mixed blessing, because it's not really owned by the company anymore. You know, people, you just use it. Yeah. It's kind of as you say, it's kind of in the vernacular and it's very much kind of owned by the public.
And with that comes the misuse of it. But I think that's part of handing it over to the public, I suppose.
Yeah. 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 Although, you know, and I have to say, you know, I think the Specsavers team, the Specsavers PR team in particular, have been really good at, you know, kind of mitigating abuses and managing it and trying to make sure that, you know, what goes out there with our name on it is, you know, is something that we would want to have our name on, you know. So I think they've done a good job of managing it over the years.
Well, I'd love to go behind the scenes. Can you do that for us? Can you draw the veil and tell me a bit about stuff that went on behind the scenes? Because we've talked about animals. We've talked about talent. You've used them both in your 18 years of making ads for Specsavers. There must be a couple of stories you can tell us.
We were filming an ad, a not terribly good ad, actually, on an aircraft carrier in Thailand. And while we were filming, Thailand declared war. They declared war on Cambodia.
Oh, right.
And suddenly we had columns of soldiers boarding the aircraft carrier that we were shooting on, headed by generals dressed in pink, which, of course, you know, is the colour that generals wear in Thailand. And we thought, oh, no, that's the end of our shoot. But the producers had words with the military, and somehow we managed to finish our day shooting while the aircraft carrier staff worked around us to prepare the ship to go off to fight.
There was no last minute script edits then to get some pink generals into.
We couldn't believe it. It was a bit sort of like, well, only in Thailand, or maybe only in some places in the world. I don't know. But we finished the show. So that was pretty dramatic. And it was dramatic. It was quite scary, actually, because there were literally thousands of soldiers boarding the aircraft carrier while we were shooting.
Any tips on working with talent? Because you very famously had Mr. Cleese in one of your ads, didn't you?
Don't say I didn't warn you. I've had it up to here with you. I'm going to give you a damn good thrashing.
We took the script, John, and we kind of got his sort of byline, if you like, really. We got him to kind of, you know, there were a couple of words that we weren't sure what he would say, and we got him to input. And I think, you know, from what I've heard, it can be a little tricky working with Mr. Cleese. But I think because we did that and we involved him in the script, and he really liked the script, and he actually contributed some small snippets to it, I think we got his buy-in. And I would say, yes, that is a very good tip. If you're working with someone, you know, who maybe has a reputation of, you know, being a little tricky, I think working with them, getting their buy-in, and making sure that, you know, they feel that they've got their name on what you're doing is a really good way to do it. And I have to say, you know, that was also, the director was Tim Bullock, and he was very good, and he worked very well with John as well, and was very patient. So have a good director and get the buy-in, get the participation. They would be my tips.
Over 18 years, you've obviously made a huge amount of variations and different types of ads for Should Have. Is there anyone that sticks in your mind that was only ever got as far as a script and you never actually got to make it?
There's always the various kind of toilet gags. There was a particularly good one that we thought, where you remember when they introduced those Dyson hand dryers, and a restaurant near us installed a row of white ones, and we did think that they did quite resemble the urinals.
No, you couldn't have made that ad. You could not have made that.
No, and we didn't.
But you should have made it.
We should have done. It's still on the list of those. You know, when we got if we've got a bit of money floating around creative, you know, I think the guys still there would still like very much to do it.
I'm picturing the spray that would have been all over the bathroom, just to make sure that we'd got the image right in our mind.
Well, I think the way that we told it in the end was it was a romantic dinner, and the guy is getting on well with the girl.
He goes back to the
table. He goes off to the bathroom and comes back splattered. His white shirt with yellow
and beige chinos.
Yeah, all over, yeah. That's what we thought. Yeah.
Well, you never know. It might get made now. I was thinking, I think maybe John Cleese isn't my favourite ad. I think it's probably certainly the most memorable for me. But I do want to put you on the spot and choose your favourite child.
It's probably between the bingo ad and the collie ad. And I think probably I would have to say that the bingo ad is my favourite one. This is the one where the Zumba teacher goes into a bingo class of elderly folk and gets them all doing Zumba.
Hi, Dad.
I'm sexy and I know it.
The last time I talked about that ad, I found a government winter fuel leaflet, you know, aimed at the old folk. And it had a picture of this poor old girl on the front, and she was sitting, you know, with a blanket on her knees, and, you know, couldn't afford the electric fire. And it was, you know, it was about, you know, kind of government aid for elderly people to keep them warm. And the lady, you know, the old lady was straight out of our ad. So I put this leaflet on the screen, and then I mixed through to the old folk dancing. And, you know, for me, that is the power of well-used humor. It empowers people. You know, you take that vulnerable person, you say, look, they're not a vulnerable person. They're fun loving. They're young at heart. They have a soul of humor, if it's not too pretentious to say that. And, you know, and humor, you know, that's for me, you know, if you use humor well, humor can empower people, you know, because basically humor uses surprise. And, you know, if you take people that you don't expect to do something and then you put them into something that, you know, they probably couldn't do, but it's brilliant to portray them doing it because that is where they are in their heads and where they are in their heart. And, you know, I mean, I'm getting a bit like that myself. And I think, you know, that's just such a powerful thing to do. And I think, you know, that was a very popular ad. And it was, and I think it's, you know, if you want to know why Specsavers advertising made Specsavers popular, you know, that kind of explains why. Yeah. Because it did that. It took kind of ordinary folk and put them, it made them, you know, unlikely heroes. Mm. Even if it was because they couldn't see very well. Yeah, and there's an old guy in a wheelchair that we've got dancing from his wheelchair. And, you know, there was a lot of debate, you know, whether we should have that shot in. But I'm so glad that we did because it's just makes the ad, you know, it makes it so strong. And I think the other ad that did that was the old couple that accidentally get on the roller coaster. And again, you know, and the comeback, you know, what kind of cheese was that at the end? Which actually kept the actor in Panto for many years.
What sort of cheese was that?
One of the most important things about working at Specsavers all that time is that we were kind of allowed to fail, you know, and failure is very important because you learn much more from failing than you do from succeeding, you know, and we did make, you know, ads that didn't work as well. We made some ads that were actually dreadful, you know, and I think that, you know, and there's all sorts of reasons for that, of course, because every creative has their list of excuses. But at the end of the day, you know, things went wrong, you know, and you learn from what everybody, and the good thing is the marketing team learned as well, you know, from what worked and what didn't. And I think, you know, the business was very tolerant and I think always was very tolerant of people trying stuff and seeing if it worked and then moving on if it didn't. And I think, you know, that was really important. And it's not a great tip, I'm afraid, because I know, you know, that's a luxury that a lot of creatives don't have. It's a tricky one. But really, you know, being allowed to do work that, you know, isn't quite right is actually so important. And I think, you know, that's why we managed to do such a lot of really good work. I actually think that is probably the single biggest factor in the fact that we did produce a lot of good work, you know.
I don't believe that all brands can carry humour off. Do you know what it is about a brand that means they could?
Humour is brilliant if you've got a brand that's a bit of a leveller, a bit of a challenger, maybe doesn't mind seeing itself as a bit irreverent, because actually irreverence is quite an important part of a lot of Specsavers humour, especially in the early years it was. And also has a very broad audience. Yeah, I think actually, you know, I didn't mention this when we were talking about what it was that appealed about Specsavers to me, but I think the fact that it does have such a broad audience was always an attraction, because you are genuinely talking to everybody, you know. So you, and I think that's what's kept the campaign so fresh. So some of the ads are, you know, some of the ads are aimed at mums with kids and at kids themselves. Some of the ads are aimed at, you know, old folk, like the Zumba ad I was talking about. And every sort of classification of humanity in between have been people that we've been talking to, you know. And that really does keep something fresh. And I think that when you've got a brand with such a broad proposition, you almost have to use humour, you know. You know, you almost have to. But I think the other thing about humour is that I think it's, you know, we were talking about John Webster and the Arkwright ads. It has to be really well written. And I think, you know, writing is something that that is very, very important if you're going to carry humour off well, you know. I think, you know, even the Tango ad, you know, you look at how that's constructed. It may not have, you know, a lot of words in it, but it's you know, it's a very well told story. And I think that, you know, that's it's a very craft and those sort of craft skills are very important if you're going to carry something off well.
So humour's obviously played a huge part in your career, but kind of it must be a reason why that is so prevalent. Tell us about kind of some of the inspiration you've got outside of your kind of your job.
Well, you know, it was Monty Python and probably slightly more obscurely Round the Horn, you know, when I was a kid, you know, Sunday lunchtimes. I think that's where, you know, the sort of, you know, delight in kind of irreverence and you know, finding odd things, oddities that are funny, you know, in ordinary existence and just not being scared of kind of trying things that maybe look a bit silly, because, you know, quite often you find that in that silliness there's real insight, you know. So I think that's what fascinates me about humor. And again, you know, this is a bit probably a bit unexpected, but Dickens as well, you know, I love Dickens. I love the way that Dickens writes when he's being funny. And the reason for that is because he writes, he hears how people think and talk, you know, and when you read, you know, I mean, his novels are always very mixed because he was also, you know, a Victorian storyteller. There's all sorts of voices in there. But when he's talking about, you know, kind of when he's talking about how folk are and think and how funny they are, you know, he's just unsurpassed.
So, Graham, nearly two decades at Specsavers, you've moved on. We all want to hear kind of what you're doing next. How you keeping your hand in, shall we say?
Well, I'm hoping to continue to do some advertising. I will definitely be picking and choosing and not doing things I don't want to do or don't kind of and don't feel engaged with. But I love writing ads. I love writing funny ads. I love making ads. That's something that I hope I will continue to do. I've directed quite a lot of Specsavers ads. So I'm quite keen on doing that for other people. So that's one area that I'm interested in. And I'm also in the sort of mid stages of writing a novel, which I hope will see the light of day one day. Writing something that I'm really passionate about. So I've been writing solidly really since I left Specsavers, mostly fiction. I've also got a book about science that I have completed. So I'm looking for a publisher for that at the moment. I am really passionate about writing, and I obviously believe in the power of words and lines in particular. And I do have a writing workshop, which you can find details about on my website, which is grahamdaltrey.com. Really, it's about, you know, it's the objective of it is to try to tell young creatives as much as I know about how to write a headline and what works and what doesn't and what to do if you're stuck. So hopefully practical and useful. It's a fairly collaborative sort of hour and a half, which involves a little bit of writing and lots of room for interjection and different viewpoints.
So, Graham, we don't usually let our guests leave without telling us their favourite ad of all time, and you very kindly sort of teased us with a few of your favourites, but go on, what's your favourite of all time, and do your best to describe it for us.
Okay, well, my favourite of all time, I won't need to be described, because I think it's probably one that everybody knows. It's the Hamlet photo booth ad, and it's my favourite ad of all time for a couple of reasons. One is that it's one of those campaign ads that is part of just a brilliant campaign thought that had that, you know, what I was talking about before, just gives the creative such a lot of latitude in terms of how you interpret it next. And the photo booth, it's, you know, it's the strongest for me of just a whole series of incredibly strong ads. And it's strong because, again, you know, just because of the craft, because it's so well acted, so brilliantly directed and performed, and so beautifully simple, and I said earlier that, you know, it's actually quite hard sometimes to think of funny ads off the top of your head, but that one always comes straight to mind.
Happiness is a cigar called Hamlet, the mild cigar.
Graham, thank you ever so much for making me cry with laughter by looking back at some of those ads. And I think on behalf of all those people who watch those YouTube channels that you didn't create, thank you for actually creating a bit of advertising history, which is going to live on and on and on. So congratulations. It's been fascinating talking to you.
Thank you so much for your kind words, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thanks, Graham.
Cheers.